Good morning. Tales from the Crypt is rising again from the grave. Today is Halloween, October 31st, and this is Morning Edition from NPR News. In this hour, a comic series returns. It's familiar to people of a certain age and a certain interest in death. I'm Steve Inskeep, dressed up as Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Renee Montaigne, in costume as Steve Inskeep. Two leading Republicans are haunting New Hampshire, Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani. Also, we'll hear the tale of a British prime minister haunted by his past. And for those having too much fun, a former narcotics officer is selling a DVD called Never Get Busted Again. This is the day the Bush administration is in court appealing an order that it charge a suspect or let him go. The news is next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. A magnitude 5.6 earthquake struck the San Francisco Bay Area last night, about 9 miles northeast of San Jose. George Herrera was walking on a San Jose street when the quake hit.
A lot of ground rumbling. That's the first thing I felt. I just felt like I looked down, felt a lot of rumbling, and next thing you know, it just started shaking.
There were no reports of injuries or serious damage. Investigators say a boy playing with matches started a fire in northern Los Angeles County that blackened more than 38,000 acres and destroyed at least 21 homes. From member station KPCC, Dolly Sakaitau reports.
The buckwheat fire in North Los Angeles County is now contained, but it burned more than 38,000 acres and destroyed at least 21 homes in the Santa Clarita area last week. Investigators with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department and the L.A. County Fire Department said they identified a young male suspect the day after the fire began 9 days ago. His name and age were not released by authorities. The fire quickly spread because of high desert winds and dry weather conditions. Sergeant Diane Hecht said in a statement the boy admitted to playing with matches and accidentally starting the fire. After talking with investigators, the boy was released to his parents. The case is expected to be handed over to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. For NPR News, I'm Dwahli Sakaitau in Los Angeles.
The Federal Reserve is meeting today to plot their next move on interest rates. NPR's Adam Davidson reports.
Many expect the Federal Reserve will cut their benchmark rate by a quarter of a percent to stimulate the economy. The logic is that the economy is still pretty shaky after months of panic about an overabundance of high-risk subprime loans. But others say the Fed won't cut rates because they'll be too afraid of triggering inflation. When the Fed rate is cut, it makes borrowing money easier and cheaper, which stimulates businesses and consumers to spend more. Sometimes a lot of new spending can send prices up far faster than is wise. At their last meeting, the Fed stunned many by cutting rates a full 0.5%, a big step. Few expect that to happen this time. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
A Spanish judge in Madrid today found 21 people guilty of involvement in the 2007 Islamist bombings of Madrid trains, which killed 191 people. It was Europe's deadliest al-Qaeda-inspired attack. 7 of the 28 accused were acquitted of any involvement in the bombings. 29 people, mostly Moroccans and Spaniards, went on trial earlier this year. One has since been acquitted. Oil prices fell in Asian trading today. U.S. light crude for December delivery fell $1.34 to $89.04 a barrel. This is NPR News. The Democrats running for president gathered for a debate last night at Drexel University in Philadelphia. As expected, Hillary Clinton's rivals went after her records and positions. She's been leading in the polls. And with 2 months before the first official voting, the pressure has grown on her rivals. NPR's David Green reports.
Both Barack Obama and John Edwards took on Hillary Clinton. They accused her of misleading voters and blurring her positions on issues. Edwards said Clinton is trying to have it both ways when it comes to the war in Iraq.
She says she will end the war, but she continues to say she'll keep combat troops in Iraq and continue combat missions in Iraq. To me, that's not ending the war. That's a continuation of the war.
Clinton said she and her challengers are really in agreement when it comes to Iraq. She said they all want most troops out, but see a need for some U.S. military personnel to remain to battle al-Qaeda. Clinton's campaign emailed reporters after the debate and said her rivals took swings at her but missed. David Green, NPR News, Philadelphia.
With less than an hour to go, the Supreme Court halted an execution in Mississippi. The last-minute reprieve for convicted killer Earl Wesley Berry is the third granted by the justices since they agreed last month to decide a challenge to Kentucky's lethal injection procedures. Berry was convicted of kidnapping a woman in 1987 and beating her to death. Berry asked for a delay at least until the court issues its decision in the Kentucky case. He claims that the mixture of deadly chemicals Mississippi uses will cause unnecessary pain, constituting cruel and unusual punishment. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Robert Half Finance and Accounting, a global recruitment firm placing financial professionals since 1948. Information at roberthalf.com.
The case of the French charity workers arrested in Chad for allegedly trying to smuggle children back to Europe continues to become more complicated. Both sides are looking to save face. Frank Browning has a report from Paris.
Although President Nicolas Sarkozy and UNICEF both denounced actions taken by the Zoe's Arc charity group, Sarkozy said Tuesday that a face-saving solution has to be found for both sides. Though France has said no technical charges have been filed against the charity workers, the Spanish air crew, and three journalists, other reports have said that the Europeans face as much as 20 years in prison on a variety of charges. French authorities also say that the group used false documents using the name Children's Rescue, complicating their legal status. Both France and Chad emphasize that the incident will not interrupt the placement of French peacekeeping forces in Chad. France's Minister for Human Rights said that France would not abandon its citizens. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning in Paris.
The Senate has approved an $11.4 billion measure to reauthorize Amtrak for 6 years. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The measure was approved 70-22 despite opposition from the Bush administration, which wants to cut the subsidy for the passenger rail service. But the railroad, which carried 26 million passengers last year, has friends on both sides of the aisle in Congress. Amtrak had revenues of $2 billion last year, but it had $3 billion in expenses. Senators defeated efforts to chip away at the operating subsidy by calling for higher food and drink prices and reducing its routes. The measure sets a goal of cutting operating costs by 40% over the six-year period. It now moves on to the House. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
The United Nations says it has received a poor response to a $41 million appeal it launched in September to help more than 160,000 victims of Hurricane Felix in Nicaragua. It says the problems caused by the hurricane are compounded by recent floods. Lisa Schlein has a report from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency calls the fighting between Ethiopian troops and insurgents in Mogadishu the worst in months. Spokeswoman Jennifer Pagona says aid workers report more people are getting ready to flee, even though the situation seems to have calmed down.
Large numbers of people have sort of packed up their belongings, but they're really rather confused about where to go, whether to stay, whether to leave the city entirely, or whether to relocate to another part of the city.
Pagona says there are reports of hundreds of families loading trucks, buses, and donkey carts with their household items. She says most are heading to the nearby town of Afgoy, which is already struggling to cope with up to 100,000 people displaced earlier in the year. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Tropical storm Noel is pushing through Cuba and moving closer to Florida. It is bringing heavy rain to the Western Caribbean. Floods and mudslides are reported across the region. Forecasters are predicting that the storm will pass over Cuba and head northeast toward the Bahamas. They also say a tropical storm watch might be issued for parts of southeastern Florida. The storm cut a destructive path across the island of Hispaniola, which is shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The storm's top winds have dropped to about 40 miles an hour, down from 60 yesterday as it moved through the Caribbean. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, a man being held as an enemy combatant gets a day in court. And one question is whether he is entitled to a day in court. He's the only person being held in the United States as an enemy combatant. And the case of Ali Al-Mari addresses some of the biggest legal issues in the war on terror. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
You might think that this long after 9/11, we would know whether the president can legally hold someone like Ali Al-Mari indefinitely without charging him. But we don't. And that's the question before the entire Fourth Circuit Appeals Court in Richmond, Virginia today. Al-Mari is a citizen of Qatar. He and his family immigrated to Peoria, Illinois on September 10, 2001. Al-Mari was in graduate school, but the government claims he's actually a terrorist sleeper agent sent to attack the United States. And Wake Forest law professor Bobby Chesney says that makes this case terribly important.
It's the most important scenario. It's an alleged Al-Qaeda member who is not on a traditional battlefield, who's in a civilian setting, but is here, according to the government, to do precisely the sorts of things that resulted in the 9/11 attacks themselves.
And the government says since Al-Mari may be an Al-Qaeda sleeper agent, the president should be able to hold him in military custody as an enemy combatant. Al-Mari's lawyer, Jonathan Hafitz, says giving the president that authority would turn the American legal system on its head.
What it would do is it would open the door to allow the president to pick up people, anyone in the United States, and hold them for the rest of their life based on executive say-so. The nation was founded on the proposition that you can't do this.
A three-judge panel of the appeals court agreed with Hafitz. They accused the president of trying to, quote, eliminate constitutional protections with the stroke of a pen. But today the case is before all 10 judges on the appeals court, and they're generally considered more conservative than the panel that ruled in Al-Mari's favor. Since 9/11, there have been two other enemy combatants in the United States, and lots of criminal trials for terrorism-related crimes. Washington attorney David Loffman handled some of those terrorism cases, including the trial of an American named Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, who's now serving 30 years in prison. Loffman says the decision of whether to indict a suspected terrorist or make him an enemy combatant almost always boils down to what kind of evidence the government has against someone.
Where the government has determined that it is likely to have admissible evidence, it is likely to permit the criminal justice system to go forward. That's what happened in the case of Abu Ali, which I prosecuted, which was under consideration for an enemy combatant designation, but which ultimately we charged in the criminal system.
On the other hand, Loffman says, if a case depends on hearsay evidence or testimony that came out under coercion or evidence that would compromise sensitive intelligence sources and methods, then the government may not be able to try the person in a criminal court, so the president goes the enemy combatant route. Traditional enemy combatants are people detained in battle. So Loffman says today's case raises the crucial question.
What is the battlefield in the war against terror? And the government's position is it is a worldwide battlefield that includes our domestic homeland.
But the panel that ruled on this case earlier this year said that position, quote, would effectively undermine all of the freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution. Today, the judges also have to consider whether they can hear Al-Mari's case at all. The government argues that a law called the Military Commissions Act cuts off Al-Mari's petition. The constitutionality of that law is teed up for consideration by the Supreme Court in a separate case later this year. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
Voters in New Hampshire still don't know when their party's primaries will be. And while there is a clear front runner on the Democratic side in New Hampshire, the Republican race for president is very fluid. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson went to the Granite State to look at two of the leading Republican candidates, Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani.
For weeks, these two Northeastern Republicans have been arguing about who is more conservative. In Manchester on Monday, Mitt Romney held one of his Ask Mitt Anything town hall meetings. Wearing a tie but no jacket, he ticks off what's at stake in November 2008. His presentation is as crisp as his starched white shirt.
I think Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards would take America on a sharp left turn with big government and big taxes and Big Brother running your lives. And I think the other course, if you will, the house that Ronald Reagan built, which is based upon personal responsibilities, individual liberties, strong families, that is the course that has the most promise for America's future.
Romney started out in New Hampshire at about 3% in the polls, surprisingly low for the governor of neighboring Massachusetts. But he's built a campaign here with business-like efficiency, investing millions of dollars in TV ads and a voter targeting operation. Now it's paying off. He has a small lead in the polls, and on Monday he received a key endorsement from the senior Republican in the state, Senator Judd Gregg. But Rudy Giuliani is running a very strong second, and many voters here have found themselves trying to decide between the two. For Susan Miller, who came to see Romney in Manchester, it came down to personal issues.
I think all of us have a sense that Rudy Giuliani did a great job during 9/11. The issue of his three marriages is, for me, who's been married for 36 years, that's an issue with me. I do like Mitt. I think he's an honest man. I think he's committed to his family.
Mayor, we have time for one more question.
Just down the road in Londonderry, Rudy Giuliani also held a town hall on Monday, where he got an opportunity to showcase his newly minted conservative approach to an issue where, as mayor of New York, he was once more liberal.
Yes, sir.
As an avid hunter and shooter, I was curious what your stand on gun control is.
Let me ask you three questions. How old are you?
43.
Okay. You have a criminal record?
No, sir.
A record of mental history?
No, sir.
Okay, you're okay. Well, that's kind of a joke, but it basically makes the point that I want to make. The Second Amendment of the Constitution gives you the right to bear and carry arms. The government can only interfere with that for very limited reasons that courts have to approve. If they go too far, it's unconstitutional.
That was a good enough answer for Charlie McCaller, who said later he will vote for Giuliani. Others, like retired military reservist Brad Thorpe of Goffstown, are still torn. Thorpe describes himself as a social conservative, and he says Romney has an edge with him there, but...
Sometimes Mitt comes away a little too polished, and Rudy is able to laugh and make fun of different... seems to be more earthy. I will consider, maybe right up to the last minute, one of these two guys based on who has the most favorables as far as beating her.
Her, of course, is Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidate who's been casting such a big shadow over the Republican nominating contest. Andy Smith, who conducts the Granite State poll, says electability, as in who can beat Hillary, has become a key test of strength in the Republican race in New Hampshire.
That's the biggest advantage that Giuliani has, is he's seen right now as the most electable candidate, but that's also his weakest point in that if he doesn't win in the early states, that electability argument's going to evaporate.
And that's what the Romney campaign is counting on. By focusing on the early states, it's using a strategy that's worked for Republicans in the past. Right now, Romney is trailing Giuliani in national polls. But, says Andy Smith, Romney's betting that will change overnight, if he wins Iowa, where he currently has a big lead.
So if he can win in Iowa and then win in New Hampshire, those voters in South Carolina and Florida and the states after New Hampshire are going to say, wow, this Mitt Romney guy, he must be something to him. He's a winner.
Until recently, Giuliani was concentrating on states like Florida, which votes on January 29th, and the big states like New York and California that vote on February 5th. But in an interview on Monday, he says he won't cede New Hampshire to Romney.
Everything we've seen in New Hampshire through our campaigning is that we have as good a chance to win New Hampshire as anybody else. We think that some people have spent, as you know, a lot of money here, tremendous amounts of money. It has not put them into some kind of commanding lead. And we haven't spent any money here yet to speak of.
But Giuliani suggests that is changing. He will start advertising on television, and he's spent almost every day this week in New Hampshire. And both Romney and Giuliani will be looking over their shoulders at John McCain, the Republican who won here in 2000 and still has a strong base of support. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
In the 1850s, a Baptist minister in rural New York made an astonishing claim. He said he'd produced the first color photographs. Not everyone believed him.
There are two camps that exist. Those believers who did think that Hill had the color process, and those that came away thinking he was a complete fraud, charlatan, humbug, all those words are used.
Photography pioneer or fake? Find out later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This Halloween morning is as good a time as any to talk about a book called The Ghost. With that title, the novelist Robert Harris refers to a different kind of ghost.
I just really was interested in this phenomenon of the ghostwriter. It implies a slight failure as a writer that you are reduced to being a ghostwriter for the money.
And so Robert Harris, a successful writer, tells the story of a ghostwriter who was supposed to help finish the memoir of a former British prime minister. He's a world leader who recently left office. The writer settles in to listen to that politician, once powerful, now unpopular, as the politician explains an episode in his life story.
It was a story he must have told 1,000 times, but you wouldn't have guessed it watching him that morning. He was sitting back in his chair, smiling at the memory, going over the same old words, using the same rehearsed gestures. He was miming, knocking on a door. And I thought, what an old trooper he was, the sort of pro who'd always make an effort to put on a good show, whether he had an audience of 1 or 1 million.
Robert Harris says he wanted to write that scene from the point of view of a ghostwriter for years.
And I couldn't find either the setting for the novel or indeed the character of the world leader, and it wasn't until about 18 months ago that I heard a report that Tony Blair could conceivably face war crimes trials and might have to seek asylum in the United States to avoid extradition, that I thought, well, that would be good. That gives me a setting, and that gives me a potential character I could use.
Well, we should mention it's not that this character is, in every detail, Tony Blair, but we do have a former British prime minister, was in office about 10 years, was very popular at the beginning. Then he was fiercely criticized for collaborating with the United States in the War on Terror, which does sound like somebody we've met before.
Put like that. Yes, of course, there are similarities between my fictional ex-prime minister called Adam Lang and Tony Blair. I wanted to get across the kind of character of politics today, and I know Tony Blair, and it seemed appropriate to satirize him in some ways, but the character himself is fictional, and in no way do I mean to imply that Mr. Blair, or indeed Mrs. Blair, because there's an ex-prime minister's wife in this book, I don't want anyone to think that I'm suggesting that they would behave in this way.
Although, there you go. How did you come to know Tony Blair?
Well, I used to be a political journalist in Britain, a columnist on the London Sunday Times, and in 1992, when he was still a rising Labour politician, he got in touch with me and we went and had lunch. And from that point on, we kept in contact and stayed in touch. We had our ups and downs, but we didn't really fall out until the invasion of Iraq, which made no sense to me. And the book is fueled with a sort of disillusion, I suppose, and a sort of anger that Britain went along with something which seemed so, even at the time, to be a bridge too far and rather illogical.
You send this former prime minister to Martha's Vineyard, where he's trying to quietly finish this multi-million-dollar memoir. It's winter. He's alone.
Yes.
It's cold on the island.
It was fantastic. I wanted to set the book in the United States, where this prime minister ends up trapped because there's a war crime investigation launched against him. The book opens with the ex-prime minister's first ghostwriter falling off the Martha's Vineyard ferry.
And drowning.
Yes, a death which turns out to be suspicious.
I want to ask about that, too. People are wondering why this first ghostwriter would have died. Did he fall? Was he thrown? Did he throw himself? One of the speculations seems to be that maybe he was driven mad by the complete emptiness of the prime minister he's trying to characterize. Do you think that all politicians end up a little bit empty, a little bit hard to find anybody home?
Yes, I think it's very, very hard not to go slightly crazy if you're in the top in politics, especially if you're there for a long time. You know, it was always an isolating job, but the level of security now, to take one obvious example, is enormous. I put a couple of things in the book which I know to be true about Tony Blair. For instance, trying to pay for a dinner for friends when on holiday in America, proudly flourishing his credit card, only to have the maitre d' at the restaurant come back and say, I'm afraid there's still this strip on it. It's never been signed or activated. These people become completely isolated from the world. I don't think a lot of world leaders these days are very well read. I don't think Mr. Blair knew very much about the Middle East. I think he assumed that invading Iraq would be a walkover, or at least that the Americans would sort it all out. And it's that kind of isolation and shallowness that's bred by the modern media age, where we seem to have lost depth in our politicians.
which you think even affects someone like Tony Blair, who for the longest time was seen as an extremely smart guy, was remaking his party and trying things that British politicians had not been able to try for years and years, if ever.
Well, he was a very smart guy, there's no doubt about that, and he was a very clever lawyer. But there's a sort of shallowness, a lawyer with a brief quality to him, which I think was, in the end, his tragedy and his undoing.
Meaning that rather than figuring out what he stood for, he was willing to pick up the case and argue it brilliantly for, well, somebody, but it wasn't even clear who for.
Yes, I mean, in a curious way, Tony Blair was George W. Bush's ghost writer himself. He made, it seemed to many people, I think in America as well as here, he made Bush's case almost better than Bush made it, and adopted a sort of subservient role to the President of the United States, which was, I don't think, in the interests of my country or yours either, particularly.
It seems easy at this moment in history to take a shot at Tony Blair. Did you find yourself as a writer struggling or working to figure out what was sympathetic or what could still be respected about this man?
Well, yes, and I hope that if people read the novel, they will see that Adam Lang, the fictional prime minister, has many qualities and is rather a noble man, a tragic figure, not vicious, not mean, not a liar either. I think it's important to remember about Tony Blair. I don't think that he ever consciously lied. I think he believed the case, or at least, like a good lawyer, convinced himself. I'm not someone who loathes all politicians as a kind of reflex action. I think they are terrific characters quite often and live on the edge, which is why one of the morals of the book is that they need ghostwriters, because people with that degree of drive and focus on the immediate issue ahead are not reflective. They are incapable of having really detailed memories like the rest of us do. They live so much in the present. That's why they can succeed. And that's why most politicians need to have a ghostwriter to flesh them out, so to speak, which is what the ghostwriter goes out to do in this book. Unfortunately, as he starts to flesh him out, he starts to realize there's something terribly wrong about this ex-prime minister and his entourage.
Robert Harris is author of The Ghost. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Just last week, the real Tony Blair sold his memoirs for a reported $9 million. To hear about Tony Blair's response to this novel, go to NPR.org. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Progressive, serving customers since 1937. Service and rate information available at progressive.com or from local independent agents. From U.S. Trust Bank of America, Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. And from Intel Corporation, committed to inspiring ingenuity and educational excellence in the next generation of innovators. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. We do not know if the luggage of a prison inmate included a bag on wheels. We do know that when a 17-year-old woman was released, her luggage contained some extra cargo. Investigators in Germany believe she left the youth prison with a fellow inmate inside her luggage. That inmate escaped and has not been seen since. An official spokesman says, and this is a quote, "Our staff are going to make sure they inspect big suitcases more carefully in the future." It's Morning Edition. From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Spain's national court has rendered verdicts in the trial for the bombing of commuter trains in Madrid 3 years ago, in which 191 people were killed. Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid reports that the verdicts included several surprises.
Several defendants got prison sentences of around 40,000 years. Lengthy sentences are common in Spain, where courts want to show that each person killed in a terrorist attack is worth up to 30 years in prison. These lengthy sentences were given to Moroccans Jamal Zugam and Othman El Gnaoui, and to Emilio Suarez Trasoras. Trasoras is a Spaniard who prosecutors say stole dynamite from a mine and sold it to the terrorists. Another surprise was an acquittal for Egyptian Rabe Osman El Sayed Ahmed. Prosecutors had presented a wiretap of a phone call in which he said the bombings were his idea. The ruling comes after 4.5 months of proceedings and another 3 months of deliberations by the judges. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
A moderate magnitude 5.6 earthquake shook the San Francisco Bay Area last night. There are no reports of injuries or major damage. But a few things broke, as Timmy Pang reported from the auto parts store where he works in San Jose.
We were helping out customers, and all of a sudden started to shake, and all of a sudden it just shook, and everybody ran into the center here, and all the glass broke over here.
The quake measured magnitude 5.6, and it was felt as far away as Santa Rosa, Sacramento, and Monterey. In a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, President Bush's nominee for Attorney General Michael Mukasey says he would study whether a controversial interrogation technique known as waterboarding was illegal. That's left some senators unsatisfied, as NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports.
Mukasey is trying to win the support of the 10 Democrats on the committee so his nomination can go to the full Senate for a vote. To now, he said he doesn't know enough about waterboarding to determine if it is torture and therefore illegal. In his letter to the committee, he pledged to study the matter and reverse any Justice Department finding that endorses the practice if he finds it illegal. Waterboarding is an interrogation technique that essentially simulates drowning. The chairman of the committee, Senator Patrick Leahy, said Mukasey's response wasn't enough. He said Mukasey should say unequivocally that waterboarding is illegal and an affront to American values and what the country stands for. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, Washington.
Other senators have said they won't vote for Mukasey's confirmation if they're not comfortable with his answers on this issue. The Commerce Department this morning says the nation's gross domestic product grew at a 3.9% annual rate in the third quarter, and that's its fastest pace in 1.5 years. Early trading on Wall Street, the Dow is up 51 points at 13,843. The Nasdaq is up 11 at 2827. This is NPR News. A bomb tore through a bus today in the central Russian city of Togliatti. 8 people were killed and more than 40 injured. Russian news agencies say investigators are trying to figure out whether someone carried the bomb onto the bus or whether it had been planted on or under the bus before it went off. NASA is assessing a problem involving one set of solar power panels on the International Space Station. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
The tear in one of the long gold solar panels is just the latest possible complication for the power supply on the space station. Until it's fixed, NASA may not be able to fully extend the panels, which means it can't produce its full load of electricity. Mission Control is looking at solutions ranging from retracting the solar panel and sending out spacewalkers to sew up the damage, or using the space station's robotic arm to grab the long boom extension and perching an astronaut on the far end to reach the rip. While this problem is being studied, engineers are also looking at a problem with solar panels on the opposite side of the station. Shavings appeared in a rotary joint. These power concerns could delay the launch of a European lab to the station set for December. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Forecasters say Tropical Storm Noel could pass over southeastern Florida in the next few days. It's already causing waves there of up to 10 feet. Its top winds are nearly 40 miles per hour. The storm already crashed through the Caribbean, causing floods and mudslides that have left at least 22 people dead. The Senate has passed an $11.4 billion bill to keep the passenger rail service Amtrak running for the next 6 years. The bill also lists steps to reduce the money-losing service's reliance on taxpayer funds and to cut its operating costs by 40% over the next 6 years. The White House opposes the bill. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree.com, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com.
a bill banning discrimination against gays and lesbians in the workplace is stalled in the House. The holdup is over extending the bill's protections to transgender people. One of the bill's sponsors is openly gay Democrat Barney Frank of Massachusetts, and it was he who removed that provision to help pass the landmark legislation.
It became clear to me that the votes are probably there for sexual orientation. That's not an easy one, but they're probably there. But they are clearly not there for the transgender piece.
Now, gay rights activists say they'd rather have no bill than one that's not all-inclusive. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Last year, when the Democrats rode to victory, gay rights groups knew they'd have their best chance yet of getting a workplace discrimination bill through Congress. Now those prospects are looking rather dim.
You know, this was kind of like having a rug pulled off from underneath us.
Matt Forman is executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force.
The fact that this has stalled out, of course, is extremely disappointing to us. We do understand the political realities. At the same time, it's, you know, very discouraging that we're not able to really count on the Democratic majority to stand together and fight for the gay community, which is an incredibly loyal base of the party, both financially and in the way in which we vote.
The bill was scheduled for a vote on the House floor last week, but was pulled so Democratic leaders could iron out differences in their caucus over just who the bill should cover. Sponsor Barney Frank says it's not the right time to include transgender protections.
We are just not far enough along on the transgender issue.
Frank likens the problem to the climate in 1972 when he first introduced gay rights legislation in Massachusetts.
I encountered a lot of, uneasiness, real unhappiness, because it was new to people. And the notion of the same-sex relationships, it troubled people. Well, we've done a lot in the past 30-plus years to educate people of that. It's only been in the past couple years that we've also begun to educate people about what it's like to be transgender.
But the only openly lesbian member of Congress and the bill's other sponsor disagrees. Representative Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin has introduced an amendment to add gender identity back into the workplace discrimination bill. She's not talking this week, but in an interview with NPR last week, she spoke of the need for a fully inclusive bill.
I think there's been a commitment that we are going to strive together to win full equal rights, not special rights, but equal rights.
Democratic leaders are working now to get Baldwin not to press for a vote on her amendment, which they say would kill the whole bill. Gay rights advocates say that's fine with them, because in many ways, the House vote is a symbolic one. There's not enough support to get the Employment Non-Discrimination Act through the Senate, and the White House has threatened a veto, despite exclusions for religious institutions and the military. Even so, Congressman Barney Frank says it's important for the House to pass the landmark gay rights legislation.
You know, if you told me in 1972, today in some states, if you say to a 15-year-old, you know what, the United States House of Representatives is going to say that you're okay, that it's wrong to treat you badly, that you should be treated the same as everybody else, even if we don't get that signed into law, that's a powerful statement.
Yesterday, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said Democrats hope to move the bill before the Thanksgiving break. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, the Capitol.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. A former cop who arrested hundreds of people is offering advice to help you avoid the same fate. He was a top narcotics officer in East Texas. Now he's selling a DVD showing marijuana users how to travel with their stash. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports on the video called Never Get Busted Again.
The opening of Barry Cooper's DVD has that same grainy quality you see on true life cop shows. There are police cars in high-speed pursuit, canines jumping into the back of pickup trucks, hidden cameras in hotel rooms where there are cardboard boxes stuffed full of marijuana bricks on the queen-size bed. It's clear this is the real thing, and the people you're watching are about to make their debut on the local news.
Live from the Permian Basin's 24-hour news leader, this is the Big 2 News Update.
These pictures are from Barry Cooper's previous life, and it's what gives him his unique credibility. As a narcotics officer in West Texas, Cooper was a law enforcement dynamo. Part of it was simply his work ethic. Stopping a couple of dozen cars a day was routine for Cooper and his ever-present canine companion.
We would pull over cars that had college bumper stickers because we knew college kids often partied with marijuana. We would pull over Vietnam vet plates because we knew a lot of our Vietnam veterans developed a habit over there, and I arrested a lot of Vietnam veterans, and I feel bad about it. And I would look for Mexicans. I would look for black people. It works.
Cooper was invited to train other police departments, and he liked to make a game of it. After 2 days in the classroom, Cooper would pick an officer and ride along with him or her for an 8-hour shift. If Cooper didn't make at least one drug bust during the shift, the cost of the training was on him. He says he never paid a dime.
There is no highway or jurisdiction that I couldn't work an 8-hour shift and put somebody in jail for drugs.
But when Cooper left West Texas and moved to Upshur County in East Texas, things began to turn sour for him. The first career blip was when Cooper arrested the mayor's son for possession of methamphetamines. He then arrested a city councilman for driving with a bag of pot and a gun. Busting long hairs on the highway was one thing, but the hotshot narcotics officer was not endearing himself to the people that mattered in East Texas. After 4 years, Cooper left law enforcement behind and then began to discovering a little of what life was like on the other side of the police baton.
I started reaping what I had sown. You see, I used to break into houses at 3 o'clock in the morning with 10 other men after throwing a flash grenade through the window, and I would drag mother and father away and send the kids to Department of Human Services over a bag of pot and totally ruin that entire family.
Without the cloak of police officer and in the middle of a contentious divorce, Cooper found himself on the wrong side of small town politics. He was arrested for unlawfully carrying a gun, then for theft for returning rental movies late. His ex-brother-in-law, a constable, showed up with an order to remove his two girls when they missed some school, but the girls put up such a fight the effort was abandoned. The complaints against Cooper were eventually reduced or dismissed, but Cooper was mad anyway. It took him a while, but eventually he figured out a way to hit back and make money while doing it.
In this section, you get to watch me make actual narcotics arrest caught from my dash-mounted patrol camera, and you get to see the mistakes others made, so pay close attention.
Cooper's Never Get Busted Again DVD has a picture of Cooper smiling in front of a big marijuana leaf. The chapters have titles like Search and Seizure, Hiding Your Stash, Narcotics Profiling, and Canines, which gives tips on how to fool drug dogs.
Remember what you've been taught? The dog can smell, hamburger patties, marijuana. But he can't communicate that to the handler. So hiding marijuana in food is a good idea because usually when the dog reacts to it, the handler just thinks the dog is being interested in food.
Cooper has dozens of tips. Surrounding your marijuana with coffee grounds does not work because the dog can still smell the dope through the coffee grounds. Instead, if you're traveling by car, bring your cat in the back seat because the dog won't stop trying to play with the cat even if they take the cat out of the car. And he laces his advice with factoids about the war on pot. For example, 750,000 Americans are arrested every year for possession. Barry Cooper's on a crusade, and he's certainly not alone among former or current law enforcement officers in his opposition to the nation's marijuana laws. But they're in the minority. For most Texas narcotics officers, never get busted again is not a laughing matter.
I don't know how he justifies having played one side of the fence and put people in jail, and then playing the other side, trying to help them avoid it. I'm not sure how he lives with himself or looks in the mirror.
Herschel Tabay is the commander of the Tarrant County Organized Crime Narcotics Unit in Fort Worth. He says Cooper had a good reputation as a narcotics officer, and that's one of the reasons Tabay resents that Cooper is aiding and abetting marijuana users and smugglers. But there's nothing he can do about it.
One of the things about America is people can do things you don't like. That doesn't make it illegal.
Cooper is planning on making a second DVD called Never Get Raided Again, and this is a project current Texas narcotics officers like even less. They're worried that this time Cooper will do more than save some marijuana user from going to jail, that passing along secrets about avoiding drug raids might wind up getting an officer hurt. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
And you can watch a video clip from Never Get Busted Again at NPR.org.
And if that's not scary enough, a series of comic books made its name by leering at people getting hurt. The series was called Tales from the Crypt. And like so many of the dead people it depicts, the comic has returned.
Hello, boils and ghouls. It's the Crypt Keeper. And I just wanted to say a good morning to my morning edition listeners.
That's the voice of actor John Cassier. He played the Crypt Keeper on the television series that in turn was based on the 1950s horror comic by the same name. The Crypt Keeper served as a host, weaving grim stories together by inserting fiendish puns between them.
I'd like to insert you into my story.
The new Tales from the Crypt comic book maintains the format of the old. That series influenced generations of young readers, from Steven Spielberg to Stephen King to horror film director John Carpenter.
I enjoyed Tales from the Crypt because they were graphic. I enjoyed the rotting corpses. I enjoyed the one where the intestines were spread all over the bases. I can't foul ball or foul play or something like that. I really loved it because you got to see it.
The newest comic offers several stories. There's the collector who buys a Japanese action figure, only to see it come to life. There's the cheap landlord condemned to live in his own rundown property, which happens to be next to a cemetery. In a comic book like this, it's not giving away too much to predict that many of the main characters will end up dead. And along the way, many will do something to make you think they deserve it. Jim Salakrup is the editor of the new Tales from the Crypt comics.
We're trying to make the Tales from the Crypt of today be sort of set in the very scary world of today, but at the same time, it's still a comic book, and compared to reality, we're not that scary.
The resurrected Tales from the Crypt is out now to inspire and terrify a whole new generation.
This is the Crypt Keeper. You're listening to Morning Edition. Happy Horror Day.
Selling your home used to be as easy as naming your price. Not so much anymore. In many areas, it's all about the extras. Some sellers now toss in plasma TVs, jacuzzis, even reportedly a car to fill half that two-car garage. I'm Neil Conan. Desperate measures for desperate home sellers. Plus, the political junkie joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most. GatesFoundation.org.
NPR's business news starts with economic growth picking up. So there's trouble in the housing market and the credit market. New numbers out this morning show the economy may be shrugging them off. The nation's gross domestic product rose during the 3 months ending in September, growing at an annual rate of 3.9%. GDP growth is the broadest measure of the nation's economic activity. NPR's Jim Zaroli is covering this story. And Jim, what happened here?
Well, that is what a lot of people are asking right now. This is simply much higher than expected. I think economists had forecast that the GDP number for the third quarter would be about 3%, maybe 3.1, and this is just higher than that. A lot of people had thought that the housing troubles were going to drag the economy down. That has happened to a degree. We see that construction spending fell by 20%, for instance, which is a sizable number. But that was offset by the fact that consumer spending was higher than expected. The consumer spending grew by 3%. We haven't seen the kind of impact on the job market. That's still 4.7% unemployment rate. So there was a marked increase in exports.
Just in a couple of seconds, Jim, if you're the Federal Reserve meeting today deciding perhaps whether to cut interest rates, how does information like this affect you?
Well, it has to raise questions about that. There was a pretty strong consensus that the Fed was going to cut rates again. I think it probably still will, but this has to give Fed members pause.
Okay. NPR's Jim Zaroli in New York. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.